World Affairs. Your host, research specialist Maeve Russell. It's been a long
time coming. Well, hello again. Another Monday afternoon rolls around, and the Dialogue Conspiracy. There's so many conspiracies in the news, I can't decide what information to share with you during the week. I brought in a bundle of articles to go over a few of them, and whatever comes through in the 45 minutes, we can share these together. One of the subjects which I've talked about on Dialogue Conspiracy before that I feel very concerned about has to do with a trial that's going to be taking place up in San Francisco called the San Quentin Six. And the men that were arrested, indicted in this particular case have been in jail. It'll be 2 years. It's 2 years this July that they've been in solitary confinement. Six men were arrested at the time of the shootout that George Jackson was killed. And this was a situation where nobody could go into the prison, examine the evidence afterwards. There were a lot of discrepancies. Members of the grand jury that indicted them, three of them walked out, and one man left forever, said he'd never come back. And the men claimed they were innocent. George Jackson was killed, and two guards were killed, and three inmates. And three political prisoners that had organized demonstrations at the prison and had strikes for better prison conditions or were organizing the Chicanos and blacks and whites to get together instead of splitting them up. These six defendants in the San Quentin case that are charged with all these murders were the political prisoners that the San Quentin officials wanted to trap and get on a murder conspiracy charge, in which case they would get the death penalty or life in jail. And the men have proclaimed their innocence, and they hardly have seen their lawyers in the 2 years. Every time they go out to visit their lawyers or leave their cells, or even if they're in their cells, they're beat up and attacked and killed. And the prison system, the California prison system, is on trial in this case, because if the men are innocent, then the prison themselves killed those guards and George Jackson in order to entrap these particular people and to kill George Jackson. At the same time, they would kill guards maybe that were sympathetic to the prisoners in the adjustment center there. George Jackson's trial was supposed to begin in 2 days. That was a famous Soledad Brothers trial. George Jackson had been in solitary confinement for 7 years. He'd been in prison for 10 years for a $70 robbery. And the trial that would have proved that he was innocent of killing a guard in Soledad was denied him. The other men were cleared of the charges, and he was murdered just before his trial. Now, the trial that would again put the prison system on to be observed for what it is going to take place. The San Quentin Six, as I say they're innocent. Would they stand trial? Every day they have been threatened with being killed for 2 years. And I started saving articles about escalation of violence in the San Quentin prison for the last 6 months or 4 months, showing to document what happened with George Jackson, that they're bringing in provocateurs and violent demonstrations, a whole series of killings before they come down and kill one, two, five, or six of these defendants. And so they brought in a whole group called the Mexican Mafia. That they've had a series of like 23 stabbings since the first of the year. And they've brought them in from I don't know where, and they've infiltrated the system. And then there was a murder up in the Adjustment Center of Tommy Horn just a couple of months ago, a member of the White Aryan group. And Tommy Horn's trial wasn't coming up. That wasn't important. The important thing was that if they have a series of stabbings and then the killing of a white boy, then to take five blacks or one Chicano isn't so obvious because it comes at the end of a series. But it's those boys they want to get because it's their trial that puts the prison system on trial. So there's been a series of violences. The Sergeant Butler, who ran the Adjustment Center, who threatened to kill these men continuously, finally got moved out of the Adjustment Center for being responsible for killing Tommy Horn. He was stabbed 22 times and put in a solitary and beaten up by the guards when he was moved into solitary, and he died there. Sergeant Butler's not in the Adjustment Center. But they've had pre-trial hearings. The case has been going 2 years, and the men are living in solitary confinement. The indictments, of course, the grand jury thing is locked up. Nobody can see on the basis that they've been in prison for 2 years. And they can't have any attorneys of their own choice. They've been fighting it to the Supreme Court to try to get their own attorneys. There's a list of well-known attorneys waiting to take their cases. The Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, I think, is deciding it now. It's been turned down on all the other cases. But every time they have a pretrial hearing, they had one 2 weeks ago, and one a week before that, the men are beat up. And they're in chains and shackles around their hands and legs and groins, and they go in, and they're beaten up. One, David Johnson, was very badly injured the last time they had a hearing. And the men are going for another pretrial hearing on Friday the 27th. And they're just, you know, when I say they're beat up, I got interested in the case at Salinas when Hugo Pinnell, who's one of the defendants, was on trial out here in Salinas last year. And at that trial that I visited, out of nothing, a witness had his hair pulled out by the hands full, and there were chains around his throat and groin, and Hugo was beat up, and they pulled guns in the courthouse, the lights go out, and everyone's yelling, and they stomp on the prisoners, and the men are, Hugo was moaning and groaning, and the day after he testified to try to prove his innocence of killing a guard, he was stabbed with fountain pens in his cell and punctured his stomach. He almost died. No medication for that, and pus set in. So Hugo's on trial. He's one of the San Quentin Six. I would like people who listen to Dialogue Conspiracy to write up to California, the Assembly. Alan Cerotti is a very good man, or Marv Dimely, or Alan Balinson. Write to Sacramento and ask that the guards who transport the San Quentin Six to the trials quit beating them up. I can say I've seen the provocations I saw with my own eyes, and I still remember that scene out here in Salinas. And the people who listen to this show, if you take the time tonight and write and ask that these men, the San Quentin Six, have a fair trial. Another thing happened this week that was in the Chronicle. There was an article sent to the Chronicle, an anonymous letter, which said that if you don't free the San Quentin Six and let them go to Algeria or Cuba, that the more guards were going to be killed. And it was an anonymous letter, and it was there's no such organization. It was something like the Black September group, but it was a group supposedly of inmates at San Quentin who sent a letter to the prison system and to the San Francisco Chronicle: if you don't release these six men, some guards are going to be killed. Now, that is pure provocateur, brought in violence. The San Quentin Six don't even know this is happening. I correspond with one of them every day. They're sitting in a cell, and somebody is setting the trap already that the men are in to a getaway thing, which is instant murder. And I've watched this escalation in anticipation for the trial, knowing the evidence of their innocence and knowing how the prison system works. They're setting them up, and they've been setting it up. And the article this week in the paper worried me, and I think we should ask for a fair trial and find out how these men were railroaded and what happens to the prisoner, like George Jackson, how they are murdered inside the prison. Dialogue Conspiracy is about conspiracies of killing presidents or candidates for presidents, and it also goes into political prisoners, because the point about political assassinations is to achieve a police state. And when you talk about a police state, you think of your prisons. You think of Nazi Germany. The prisons were a very important part of it. And white American can sit back and say, well, that's just a few blacks or a Chicano. It doesn't affect me. If they're there, they must be guilty. But it's going to come down later on all of us, and that isn't the reason to be concerned. It's just that the men are innocent. They've been framed, and they shouldn't be beaten up. They go to the trial, and they're just beaten up and brutalized. So write up to Alan Cerotti, care of the Assembly up in Sacramento, and ask that security guards that don't hurt these men guard them going back and forth from San Quentin to Marin County. And that would be a big step in helping to keep them alive instead of being brutalized, because they want to prove their innocence. They want to be alive to go to a trial. And it's a day-to-day existence of whether or not they'll be able to or not. Well, there's a lot of things in the news. There's an Alan Lowenstein who had an interview. He's one of the men on Richard Nixon's enemy list, and he wanted to dump Johnson in 68, and he didn't want Richard Nixon. You can see why he went around wanting to impeach Nixon, and he didn't want Johnson as president, and he's a former representative from New York City. Lowenstein had a lot of things happen to him, and he noticed that he was seventh on the enemy list, which said marked for action, in quotes. The enemy list is that White House document to get at the political opponents of Richard Nixon after the election. Some have been happening, taking place before, but then there was a list for some to get to afterwards. And Lowenstein had a list in the paper today of different things that had happened to him in his campaigns, and evidently some things that happened to his family, which he said were a series of accidents, which he didn't go into. But the New York Times had an article about Lowenstein that was different than the San Francisco Chronicle. In the Chronicle, you only get part of the news. What they left out was that he said that an examination after the Watergate has brought out something very frightening in terms of the enemy list, and it's brought out these accidents in his own personal life. He said, I've been plagued with accidents in my own life. But more recently, he said in an interview, there should be a deeper examination of a wide range of events, from elections to assassinations, that may not have happened the way is now generally accepted. And he goes on to the fact that there's this big hysteria about the anti-war people and about the hippies, that the excuse for the plumbers were the anti-war people and the protesters. And all of a sudden he realized that the enemy on the list were not the youth or Abby Hoffman or Jerry Rubin at all. They were the people who were representing the establishment but weren't Richard Nixon people. And he gave the example of Arnold Picker, a chief fundraiser for Senator Edmund Muskie. They weren't the radicals at all that were the enemy. They're very much establishment, but they're not Republicans. And he brought the question about the riots in the past years and the assassinations, the political assassinations. Well, the researchers on assassinations have been saying that there's a link between election manipulation and the murders, that they are murders. They're not single isolated events like Oswald or Sirhan or James Ray or Arthur Braemar. But this is a fairly establishment person, Mr. Lowenstein, coming out now and beginning to see a chain of command and seeing that what happened in the White House wasn't any radical demonstrators at all, that the excuse for coming down with the interagency departments and to create a police state was the radicals, but the people they were going to come down on were the opponents of Richard Nixon, the strong Democrats, whether they're for Humphrey or Muskie or McGovern. It had nothing to do with McGovern radicals at all. There's one other letter, if you give your homework for the week, there's another letter I think you should write, which is really important to members of the Senate. I don't know how many of you can sit down and write 10 or 12 letters in one evening. I do it when I have something that's important. And there's one appointment that's been held up. We got Mr. Clarence Kelly of the CIA, who went through unanimously, and Mr. Schlesinger of the Department of Defense. But they're holding up the appointment of William Colby. And this is a time where we're talking about elections being sabotaged and police state and government being overthrown. And William Colby is the epitome of all the evil things that America's done in the last years. He's been suggested as the head of the CIA by Richard Nixon, and this appointment is such an insult to what the Watergate is about. And if the American people sit back and accept this without a protest, they almost deserve Mr. Colby. He was the head of the dreaded Phoenix program in Vietnam that displaced whole villages and populations, spread terror, the kind that we are granting in America with the special forces, I call it paramilitary operations, coming down on areas of our communities in a very systematic way. One of them is that Dale program, that drug program. And a lot of terrorists, the Mau Mau killing in Virgin Islands at the time of the elections, the Chicago, Illinois murders, a series that ran through the suburbs there, and the Manson thing was a terror movie done by the Special Force kind of operation. called the Manson. It was actually a paramilitary coming in, cutting the wires, and killing these people, replacing the bodies in a certain position and leaving. Well, Mr. Colby was the master at spreading terror against one faction of a community, against each other, and that's what happens with the Manson thing. You turn the youth against their parents, the parents turn on the youth, and society turns on the young people because they identify them with the killers. Mr. Colby had, or still had, 40,000 political prisoners who were opponents of Premier Thu locked in jail. There's been pictures recently of torture and exposures of things going on, and they're still being arrested. The Phoenix program is still going. It's synonymous with throwing people out of aeroplanes, taking three men up, and then throwing one out so that the other two would talk. And he's been charged by a former CIA official of doctoring the elections down there and rigging the elections the year the DM got in. DM got 90% of the votes, and there's documents existing that Colby was manipulating the elections down there. A Mr. Sakawa, who worked with the CIA from 1959 to 1962 and then left there, took documents with him that charged William Colby with slanting the intelligence data, submitting misinformation, permitting Americans' funds to be used to rig the 61 election in South Vietnam. Well, a man who's synonymous with covert activity, dirty tricks, rigging elections, population displacement, torture, tiger cages, his political assassinations, is hardly the man that we would want in the United States of America to be running our domestic agencies, particularly at a time where the CIA is being investigated for infiltrating the American population to the extent that it did. Ehrlichman testified before the grand jury in Los Angeles. He hasn't come out. He'll be the witness tomorrow, John Ehrlichman, at the Watergate hearings. But he came out in Los Angeles and claimed that the Central Intelligence Agency was behind the Watergate operation and the Ellsberg. He claims that the agents were working for the CIA all along. And this is one of the things I said in the Realist article that I did a year ago last July, that the whole Watergate affair was a CIA operation. John Ehrlichman came out this last week, and what he said was, and this is interesting, the point, a lot of people wonder, well, working for the White House and under White House salary, why would Hunt and Liddy be going to a psychiatrist's office? There's nothing about leaks out of Beverly Hills, California, of Daniel Ellsberg. But John Ehrlichman testified at the grand jury that what they were doing is that they were working for the CIA. In other words, the plumbers was just a cover. They were working for the CIA, and they were getting Ellsberg's conversations with his doctor so they could build a psychiatric profile for the Central Intelligence Agency. See, the CIA, the charter of 1947, said they can't operate inside the United States. So they have a man who's been there for 21 years, like Howard Hunt, and then he leaves. Then he goes to work for the White House. But while he's at the White House, he's ex-CIA. He's not CIA anymore, but he can go to the CIA and say, give me the wig, give me the speech impediment machinery, pay for my transportation. They give him the consecutive $100 bills, pick up other CIA agents down in Miami, go out to the Beverly Hills offices, and then they split and went back to Miami and Washington, and then use government money to go back out to Beverly Hills. Well, John Ehrlichman is saying that this is done for the Central Intelligence Agency to build up psychological profiles. And it's interesting because they can also get the names of people in Ellsberg's family. They can harm people he knows. They can use this in a lot of different ways to get at Daniel Ellsberg. Another thing that came out in the Ehrlichman testimony in the grand jury in Los Angeles was the fact that Judge Matthew Byrne, who was presiding over the Ellsberg trial at the time it was taking place, went down to San Clemente to see Richard Nixon about heading the FBI, about getting that appointment for the head of the FBI, which is highly illegal to be conducting one investigation and considering a raise or appointment at the time. Well, he had a second appointment with John Ehrlichman, and the general opinion, if you can believe John Ehrlichman, the opinion in the first place was that Ehrlichman called him back a second time. But what Ehrlichman is saying this last week is to the Los Angeles grand jury, as far as the Ellsberg case goes, was that Judge Byrne, Matt Byrne, contacted him the second time and said, I want to see you. So Judge Byrne had a second meeting with John Ehrlichman, and this was like all the other meetings. If you're watching the televised hearings of the Senate committee, this one was at a public park. Now, these men, there's all kinds of information about their rooms being bugged, and they're bugging each other, and we'll go into some of that if we have time. The monster they created is turning on themselves, the data banks and the electronic bugging. But the charges are made that Judge Byrne called John Ehrlichman, and they met in a public park and had this conversation, and that Richard Kleindienst was part of the endorsement of Byrne having this second meeting. Now, these were heavy charges because the point is brought out that if Richard Kleindienst was in on this, he would be subject to discipline by the Bar Association if he set up Judge Byrne with, at the time that this was going on, the former attorney general. It would be improper for him to set up a meeting between Judge Byrne and Ehrlichman at the time that the trial is going on. So this would be grounds for impeachment if it's true for the judge or disbarment. If Judge Byrne initiated the second call to Ehrlichman, then the California Bar Association that's working on disbarring Richard Nixon, Herbert Kalmbach, John Ehrlichman, and others are considering disbarment of Judge Byrne if he set up that appointment. So Ehrlichman, one of the two, is not telling the truth. Now, the lawyers, there's been several articles recently about all the lawyers that are involved in the Watergate scandal, and I think to take that thought for a few minutes and share it is very important. It's as important as all the evidence or conversations or wire logs that are taking place for this reason. In the first place, this administration has stressed law and order so much, and they've talked about these young scoundrels and these hippies and these dirty dropouts and the anti-war protesters and for throwing rocks at a car, and they were the ones who observed law and order, get tough on the prisoner, get tough on the drug dealer, and keep America safe. They're going to clean everything up with their anti-pornography law. They're going to keep this really nice, safe, clean country for the law-abiding citizens. So all of a sudden, you have a situation where at least 30 lawyers are involved who can be disbarred, and there's 125 lawyers being investigated. Well, it's called the worst lawyer scandal in the history of America. But when did it start? I don't know anything about law corruption. I've never been to many law courts, very few. I've seen some rigged courts. The few experiences I've had, I went to trials that were all stacked against the defendant in a evil way. The lawyer is, I guess, one of the lowest forms of humanity because he has a duty to serve or supposedly to serve, and it just goes completely out the window. But I think the example of the way a president behaves or the chief justice behaves or the attorney general is indicative of the way the whole nation is rotten or rots. And the use of Earl Warren to head the Warren Commission was such a perversion that anything I read about lawyers I can believe or see if I go to the courts, because Earl Warren signed his name to a fictitious document called the Warren Report. A president of the United States was murdered in Dallas, and this terrible document, just a piece of junk, not a word of truth in it. Once Mark Lane, who did research, early research, wrote a book, Rush to Judgment, he said the Warren Report only has two sentences in there that are true, and one is that John Kennedy was killed, and the other was that Oswald was killed, Lee Harvey Oswald. And Officer Tippit was killed, too, in Dallas. And outside of that, you can't find two sentences that hold up. Well, it takes a certain genius to put together a book of 800 pages with 552 witnesses and 13,000 documents and not find any truth. And I spent 8 years taking that thing apart, because it really gets fascinating, the lingo of the Warren Report and the way they falsify documents. So when the nation in 1973 gets surprised that the legal profession is corrupt or that the attorney general is sitting and planning conspiracies in his office, anything can happen after you study what the Earl Warren did at the time of investigating the John Kennedy assassination. Once before, a while ago, I read a couple of memos on Dialogue Conspiracy, and I was using them again last night for something I was writing and had them on my desk. And when I saw the article about lawyers today, it came back to my mind. And one of them was a letter from a member of the Warren Commission named David Slauson, and he was writing to Howard Willens September the 28th. And the Warren report was going to press about September the 29th. So they had 7 days before it went to press, and then it would be on sale the first week in October. So they were talking about Lee Harvey Oswald. This was pending matters, the subject matter is pending matters, and they were talking about a commission exhibit 3074, and it had to do with Lee Harvey Oswald at a hotel in Mexico City. And it was very important testimony because the people that were at the hotel with him in Mexico City were linked to evidence of the killing of John Kennedy later. About seven times these people came out in other parts of the commission exhibit. So their being at the hotel was very important. So what David Slauson wrote was about this particular matter. They're writing the report. And he says, we have additional or substantive authority from the FBI. Substitute, he says, on Chapter 6. He says, the FBI wouldn't give us, they weren't able to get a comprehensive list of the Hotel del Comercio guests. But what I have done, he says, I've inserted a phantom commission number and we'll fill it in with something. And I believe I have fudged the text sufficiently so that anything we do can be fitted in. Now, this is signed by a lawyer from the Warren Commission. So you see, all the fuss about the presidential logs doesn't mean much when this particular lawyer says, I have fudged it, and we can fill in anything we want. In other words, we don't have one document, and we'll fudge another. Another document that I have which shows you the way that lawyers write reports or do investigations had to do with the Ruby, the conspiracy of Ruby knowing Oswald or whether Ruby knew oil people in Texas. And they said, we have no information about whether or not there was a conspiracy because we didn't go into it. So we can say in the Warren Report that as far as we have gone, we haven't come to any evidence of a conspiracy. And this is what their letter said. They can't rule it out, they said, because Ruby's still alive, but we have no evidence of a conspiracy. And that is a true statement because they said we haven't looked for it. And that letter was written August 14th. And the part about whether or not Jack Ruby knew people who hired him or arranged for him to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, the Warren Report said there was absolutely no evidence of a conspiracy for Ruby to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. And the letters of the commission that I got from the National Archives said that they could say this honestly because they didn't investigate it. So that's the way the lawyers work. When you get Earl Rankin, the chief attorney for the Warren Commission, selecting an all-CIA staff, the selection of the staff was so top secret, it's locked up for 75 years. And then in Los Angeles, California, when Robert Kennedy was killed, Evel Younger, another lawyer, was the district attorney. Now he's the attorney general of California, and he sat on all the evidence of the conspiracy to kill the man who was running against Nixon in 68. So when Attorney General John Mitchell's involved at the Watergate, it really is not much of a surprise. The charges against the Watergate lawyers, it's been described as the worst scandal in American legal profession, and they've been accused of many things. It involves lawyers such as President Nixon all the way down to lawyers that work for the FBI. In 7 weeks of Watergate testimony and the proceedings, it implicated lawyers in a lot of charges, which they call unethical. They're trying to find out what guidelines lawyers should use. But they're not only unethical, they're absolutely illegal. They were conceiving and approving and carrying on a break-in and bugging at the Democratic National Committee. They directed extra-legal schemes in the name of national security and committed felonies and burglaries and fire bombings. And their one objective, they said, was to stop security leaks, but they were going to bomb buildings. And I've mentioned once before on a show two churches that were burned down up in Seattle by a CIA agent to blame hippies and Antichrist people. They do fire bombings. Lawyers sat in on the planning of fire bombings. They financed and conducted a campaign of political sabotage and espionage against all of the contenders. They withheld and destroyed crucial evidence that would have tied the committee for the re-election of the president right to the White House. They rehearsed perjured testimony over again that concealed any involvement of the White House in bribery or in the plot to bribe. They bribed the seven original Watergate defendants to keep silent. They failed to inform the authorities of suspected criminal activity, despite their service in law enforcement positions where they swore that if they knew of something they were supposed to report it, they didn't do it. These lawyers ignored a legal requirement imposed by the Supreme Court to notify the judge in any case where wiretapping and burglary has taken place. They kept this information and didn't inform the judge. They attempted to shift the blame for the illicit Watergate operation on the CIA to hide, these lawyers helped do that, to hide the involvement of the White House. They accepted hundreds and thousands of dollars of fees and defense funds in $100 bills. They received money from people they didn't know that was put in containers that they didn't know what was in it and delivered to other people that they didn't know, you know, this three-way transaction. They tried to use the legal process to accomplish political objectives such as forgetting the president. There's an enemy list, and they used their legal know-how, the Internal Revenue, to break people, get their tax audits investigated. They made ex parte contracts with two legal judges presiding over criminal and civil cases, with Judge Byrne and also with Judge Ritchie, which is a violent violation of ethical structures. They solicited campaign contributions from corporation officials, which is against the law. They contradicted each other in sworn testimony before the grand jury, and they contradicted themselves. You heard Mr. Moore. He was a lawyer for the White House. He made a statement on a matter, one statement, and then he made one that contradicted himself. And they said, which one is it? And he said, well, whichever you want. His answer was, take whichever you want. They contradict each other, and they contradict themselves, and you can take whichever you want. Now, the legal profession is trying to ask, what is going on? In California, it's usually a secret until they get a disbarment procedure going. It's a procedure not to list the names, but it's been revealed that in California, the question of taking away the license to practice law is under investigation for Richard Nixon, John Ehrlichman, Herbert Kalmbach, Gordon Strom, and Donald Segretti. In New York, the Bar Association has opened the files of John Mitchell and Gordon Strom, who practiced law in the office of Mitchell and Nixon. And Strom and Mitchell are the two people that they're checking out now in the New York Bar Association. There's six other New York attorneys that are implicated, that they're working on the papers now, lining those up. John Mitchell's been indicted in the Vesco charges, and he has a lot of counts against him besides perjury. He's been charged with felony and perjury, and that automatically leads to disbarment in New York. And G. Gordon Liddy, who's already in jail, has lost his law degree. He was already convicted of six counts of conspiracy, bugging, secondary burglary. This is an ex-FBI man who was also a lawyer. He's lost his law degree. The District of Columbia, there's John Dean and Charles W. Colson and Patrick Gray, and they're going into the bar problems of those particular people in District of Columbia. There are 125 attorneys being investigated. 56 of them are Washington, D.C. lawyers who have figured in the case. It doesn't mean they're guilty, but their names have come up, and they've transacted money. They have hidden. They've allowed perjury. They knew perjury of a witness. He'd come and say, I'm going to perjure myself. They didn't turn it in. They have been lawyers for the lawyers that are under investigation now, like, say, John Ehrlichman's lawyer, Haldeman's lawyer, Mitchell's lawyer. If they knew there was perjury, if they knew there were these problems and they don't turn it in, then they themselves, if they knew there was wiretapping, then those attorneys are also responsible and can lose their law license. Ehrlichman is from Seattle, Washington. Egil Crow is another top lawyer who is in trouble, and they're investigating his law license. The law schools are questioning, you know, where is the ethics of it? What is the discipline? What do you do with lawyers that whose service is a political goal or being so close to power that the laws just don't exist for these people? One of the big problems in this country that is not recognized, and I just finished writing another article for The Realist this week, and the thing that people don't realize is that Richard Nixon and these lawyers do not consider themselves breaking a law because they are actually war criminals. They are carrying on these paramilitary operations against us at home, killing the prisoners, killing civilians, hippies, hitchhikers, musicians at rock concerts. They are conducting a warfare at home, and to them, anybody who isn't like them is equal to a communist, even if it's Hubert Humphrey or Senator Muskie. So if they have to save the world for their kind, then they're merely conducting a paramilitary operation. You don't have a legal permission to murder a man in a village of My Lai. You go in and take the women and children, and the legal system protects you because it's a war. And these men have been protected. These 125 lawyers have not done anything wrong because they are in a state of war. They think this is an emergency, that it's the only way to save the country. Their mind is bent that they're in a battle. The only difference is that they've been conducting a warfare, but the enemy haven't known it's going on. They just have been ignorant to the fact, you know, of what's happening. They're catching on now, but they don't really realize the depth of the warfare going on against them. And an example of the war, and I think it was beautiful this week, was Mr. Alexander Butterfield, who went before the commission, because these modernized weapons of war that the administration uses aren't only laser beams and all their fancy guns and tanks and airplanes that fly themselves, but it's been a battle of them with computer, data bank, keeping track of everybody, surveillance, photographing us at the peace marches, demonstrations, people that object on their taxes to the warfare state. Well, the data bank and the computer are things that they can't work with to collect information, files, and tapes on everybody and everyone that they deal with, like coming out of the White House as a potential enemy or potential friend. So the president got himself nice and bugged and took down all these conversations, and Ehrlichman was bugged, Haldeman and Mitchell's conversations being wiretapped, and when John Dean talked to the president, he mumbles into something for fear the bug will pick up what he's saying about Charles Colson. So when Alexander Butterfield, got on the stand this week and talked about the electronic White House with everything being bugged, the bugs came back on them as monsters. They created this monster, and now it can prove their guilt or innocence. And there's no way to take this administration and take a one-hour tape and find them innocent of any of the charges. I'm sure that every conversation is filled with dynamite, and it'd be hard to erase all of that. It's available. It's been subpoenaed. I don't see any way they can deliver it. I don't know what will happen, but there's no way they can deliver this kind of information. Now, Mr. Butterfield came in to talk about the logs this week, but he brought up an interesting point, because here's the man who was taking from every room in the White House conversations the president was talking about his most personal business and foreign affairs, dignitaries, everybody's coming through that White House. And Mr. Butterfield seems to be the CIA babysitter in charge of communications of Richard Nixon. He's an important man. But when they asked him where these logs were, he said they were with Al Wong of the Secret Service. Now, Al Wong is somebody that I mentioned twice in an article I did a year ago, that one in The Realist, as a very important person in the conspiratorial part of the Richard Nixon administration. And his name came out again today when Gordon Strong was talking, because Butterfield not only Al Wong worked with Butterfield, who was taking the presidential tapes. Al Wong interviewed and hired James McCord. And Butterfield kept a secret cash fund of $350,000 with a private policeman, again by the name of Lilly, that came up, who is not on the payroll of the White House, who goes around distributing $300,000. And you get a little triangle in the White House here of one man, Butterfield, taking the tapes of the president, the conversations, knowing where he is in the room at all times and where he's moving or who would see him. I'm thinking in terms of whether he'd be assassinated with an appointment like Andrew Topping coming to see him. Somebody has control of everywhere he goes and everything he does. At the same time, He works closely with the Secret Service, Al Wong of the Secret Service, and James McCord, who was chief of security for the committee to reelect the president, who was going down to Miami to make the offices and the president secure. You have secret funding. Now, it's important that secret funding is $300,000. Eddie, Mr. Lilly delivering their money. This group kept the logs on the president. They had secret hundreds of thousands of dollars for their own use, and they were working with McCord and the provocateurs that were going to have the violence in Miami. And it goes back to that story I did about the planned violence in Miami and the chance that Richard Nixon would be killed. Mr. Butterfield was very important to Nixon. He kept track of every room he was in, where he walked, where he went out of the rooms. But the important thing about him was that when the plane went down over Chicago that Dorothy Hunt was on, carrying this payoff money and her suitcase full of money, when her plane crashed, Butterfield was taken immediately out of the White House to a position of Federal Aviation, Chief of Federal Aviation. Well, Dwight Chapin, who was the appointment secretary that worked with Gordon Strom and Segretti, he went to Chicago to work for the United Airlines, be in all the hearings of the plane that carried Dorothy Hunt. A. Jill Crow, who worked with the plumbers, Hunt and Liddy had hired them and was in charge of their operation from the National Security Council, the CIA, went to the Department of Transportation, and Butterfield went to the Federal Aviation. So the top espionage team of Dirty Tricks were covering this airplane and trying to keep the sabotage down. So that is very convincing that Sherman Skolnick's evidence is, it's confirmed more and more by this group. What's really troublesome is that extra hundreds of thousands of dollars that Butterfield was giving to Mr. Lilly. That was a new name that came out today that we have to watch. The president had a little sickness this week. He got over it fast. Senator Sam Ervin wanted the White House logs, and Richard Nixon said, you can't have them. So there was going to be a little issue over that when Richard Nixon went to the hospital, and you can't beat a man when he's down. That wouldn't be fair. So he got himself tucked into bed for 1 to 3 weeks, but he was seeing Mr. Kissinger, and he was seeing General Haig, because to Richard Nixon, foreign affairs, to save the country, for the foreign affairs is important. Domestic affairs are not important. So Sam Ervin would have to wait for the court visit until he recuperated. And he was waiting to see how the president's lung was catching on, and there was talk that he'd be there for 3 weeks. But then when Butterfield got on the stand last week and said the White House was bugged, everything was bugged, and that the tapes exist, Nixon jumped out of bed really fast. Because my paper said he'd be there 3 weeks, which I thought was outrageous. And all of a sudden, he jumped out of bed. The Monterey Herald this week had an article in the paper when Nixon left the hospital. The doctors said, now go down to Camp David or San Clemente, rest, and get some swimming in. It's a funny kind of pneumonia to be swimming. But he jumped out so fast, and I'm sure it was to take care of the logs. And then there were articles. Richard Nixon loves to walk in the country. Well, walking with B.B. Rebozo is the kind of walk that Ehrlichman does with Judge Byrne. The rooms are all tapped and bugged. I'm sure there's instructions of what to do next or strategy, so he went down to Camp David. Then he sent a letter to Sam Ervin, you can't have the logs, nothing will be accomplished. So the whole illness episode didn't really accomplish too much. It's true, he looks sick, he looks terrible, but I don't think there are very many people that believe that the timing of the pneumonia, the way he fell into bed and fell out, that there was too much to it. The most important man of the so far, besides Butterfield, that's on the stand, if you can say him most important, in terms of dialogue conspiracy, was Anthony Lasowitz, who was on last week as a witness. And only Senator Weicker takes him seriously, takes the thing seriously, and stopped their laughter and reminded Mr. Lasowitz where all these parties were that he was talking about, like Howard Hunt in jail and Dorothy Hunt dead. And he took it back to the serious tone. And there's a very interesting information about Anthony Lasowitz and John Caulfield. The true story about these agents working inside the White House, it's shocking. You know, working inside the White House, getting this money from the New York Police Department and salary. Lasowitz getting $100,000. The attorney for Richard Nixon, Kaulbach, handing this money in 69. The truth of their activities will just begin to surface. But it seems that Mr. Caulfield has worked in the New York Police Department for a long time, but he's worked, he has had access to the private papers of the intelligence agencies and worked with the CIA that worked in the police department of New York City. Now, Mr. Mowery, the CIA, has defended the right of them to help police departments, but you get Mr. Caulfield working with them in New York City. He worked in their files, in their computerized files, and he had access to the police files of radicals in New York City. Caulfield has known Richard Nixon since 1960. In 1960, when Nixon was the vice president, he was on the security force assigned to Richard Nixon. He was with him in 68, and he was not off of the police department in New York City. He was going to retire. He was still working for them when he went to Chappaquiddick in 1969 and was working for the White House on Senator Kennedy's accident at Chappaquiddick. He was still under the payroll of the New York City police. So a lot is going to come out about the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau that Mr. Caulfield worked for at the time. And that is the same year and the same division that was charged, and there's tapes of this group talking on the telephone to kill Cesar Chavez and Eldridge Cleaver. And because the White House Department papers say how they were out to kill Cleaver, this is in the memos, on the enemy list, it would be interesting now to replay those tapes of the conversations in the Treasury Department and see if we pick up the voices of these men making a deal in California with Larry Shears to kill Cesar Chavez and Eldridge Cleaver. Well, our time is up. I wanted to talk about some more about Mr. Lasowitz working in New York City with the radicals and his background, but time is up. Keep watching the hearings. Write to the Assembly up in Sacramento, any of the men you like, Bielenson and the others, tell them to please keep the San Quentin Six alive, and write to Washington, any of the senators. Write 10 letters tonight. Don't have Colby as the head of the CIA. It's a dangerous precedent. You'll be sorry if you do. So please try and get him out, and we'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy featuring research specialist Mae Brussel.
Such a long, 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 long time before the dawn.
I was rereading some of it today because still it's time to pause the, you know, we're going to go over it again. I just said that it's better to read it. It's good. I'm satisfied. I just want to read it.
Fantastic. I can't wait to read it. You're excited.
It's good.
We got one call over here. You want to talk
about it? Okay. It's really, I'm really happy about it, you know. I feel like I'm, you know, high.
To bring some love.
Yeah. Oh, where do you work? Where do you live? Oh, how do you support yourself?
Head picket line. Don't punish me.
Tell me how do you pay for gas.
Oh, speak to me.
How do you pay that?
So you can see. Oh, what's going on?
What are you gonna do?
What's going on?
need help, but I always have to know that I have to be careful.
Wait, I better take this to the other room. Do you need me?
I have to always be careful, you know, of how people support themselves and what they do. Some guy called me on, they called me a call that I can't just take, you know? I mean, if they don't have an income coming in some way, you know, that can explain how they maintain themselves, I don't know where they come from. I mean, they don't have to be rich. They may have food stamps, but I have to know who's paying their bread. It's not the government. Yeah. You want to cut articles and stuff that you want to do? Well, I need help, yeah. Well, let me have your name. I'll call you. Do you have a phone? Because our hair is long. Who's that? Oh, yeah. We've got the plan. Yeah. What's your name? Before I go, well, there's a realist. Well, you'll have the next one. Hello? Yeah. This train, but you see it?
Cassie.
Okay. Just leave.
Bobby Kennedy, do you
thing I told him about the article, can I do it? Do you want to have a thing here?
Well, I would love to.
How are we going to do this?
Billy's never do it. Jerry Lewis and Bob Belly and Bill Gale at the State Theater. Sure, we could have a charity showing, but the Village Theater guy isn't very cooperative for that kind of thing. Unless, okay. I mean, I just don't know. He doesn't work with KLRB at all.
Yeah, well, let's see about the theater. How do I go about getting it done?
The guy who owns manages the theaters at the mouth of the valley, which used to be Jersey, this guy named Miles, who listens to this radio station a lot.
Well, I asked him if he wants to have a second gun, because see, the John Gandy, is big, like the Godfather, that's the John Gandy, this is the Robert, I mean, just far out.
Okay.
And Chirac said he'd have the premier showing up here because, you know, like a lot of people in Sprague was here and I could read people from Santa Cruz and stuff.
Great. Okay, if he's willing to have the opening here, then I'll talk
ask
to Miles.
Him.
I don't know why it could be done.
About,
I don't think so.
Yeah, he's going to raise money and then if they have extra copies made to distribute around the country.
Fantastic. Okay.
Yeah, because he didn't get the support of the big, but he's got the doctors and the autopsy and all the ballistics. It's really good.
Okay, is this your
Oh,
that's
right. My chemicals. Thank you. What is that?
Shoes of the thing that Mom went to look for.
Oh, that's your block. Hi, all right. I'll go down again.
I take for ice cream.
Okay, pardon me. I'll go to Safeway so you can do it while we're doing it. Okay, I'll go get her at the store. Oh, where is she at? The toy store? They want to close the over there. Okay. Hold this a second.
What
did
you
buy? A pool?
Okay.
like when he's posturing, it's best just to talk about and say, you're doing this, you're doing that, just call it games, you know? And see if they're games or not. If they're not, he'll get worse. If they are, he'll get better. I'm happy when I see him this way, you know, like,